From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Linda Burney is one of a handful of Indigenous Australians in the federal parliament. She went national after a long career in the New South Wales House. Linda Burney is Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians and Shadow Minister for Families and Social Services. She joins us today as the Labor Party's national conference is in its final stages.
Opportunity must be more equally shared. We are a better nation because we embrace a diversity of faiths, beliefs, and worldviews. We must remain vigilant against racism and extremism, which diminish and divide. Friends and delegates, I am proud and thankful for all of the work that has gone into this chapter, in particular from the grassroots of our party, whose work and amendments are reflected in this chapter. It outlines Labor's vision for an inclusive, fair Australia. Delegates, I move Chapter 5.
Linda Burney, let's start on the issues about women. In all this very extensive debate, it seems to me that the plight of many Indigenous women has been largely overlooked. Do you agree with this? And if so, why do you think that's happened?
I think the voices of a number of groups have not been heard. And I urge particularly the Prime Minister's task force, the fact that they're talking about some sort of summit, to ensure that there are women from a First Nations background, from the disability sector, and from the multicultural sector are very much heard. And the reason that that's important, Michelle, is that the ideas around how you deal with the issue of domestic violence and respect, and some of the drivers in those communities may be quite different to the broader mainstream community.
And I don't think in all those things that were tacked on, there was any mention of Indigenous women indeed.
There is absolutely no mention. When you have a look at the reshuffle, you've got Jane Hume, who had the brilliant idea recently of for women who are escaping domestic violence to actually use their superannuation. Thankfully, lots of pressure from Labor and other quarters, that was abandoned. You have Karen Andrews, who is on the front pages of many of the newspapers today, but one thing that really struck me, Michelle, which I found quite bizarre, was the Prime Minister still saying that Maurice Payne, who is the Minister for Women, will become the Prime Minister for Women. Well, he's our Prime Minister, and I still think he doesn't actually get it. He doesn't get the extent of the anger and the frustration in the parliament and in the broader community about the issue of respect for women.
Now, just on this question of violence towards Indigenous women, how serious is this problem? We know it's very serious, but do you have any facts and figures on how serious? And you mentioned that the factors involved were somewhat different from the general community. Can you just spell out that for us, what these factors are and the differences?
Well, so the factors and the differences are, let's start with the first part of your question. The statistics for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in terms of violence are off the Richter scale. We know that for Aboriginal women under the age of 40, the biggest cause of homicide is in fact violence. We know that the extent of violence and assault of Aboriginal women is something like 45 times more likely. Now, remember, we're about 3% of the population, and the fact that there is a 45% likelihood of Aboriginal women who are experiencing this sort of thing is just way out of proportion to anywhere else in society. And the thing that I really wanted to point out to Michelle is that it is not just about women who end up as a homicide statistics. And I don't have any figures on this, I'm sorry. But I think we need to start thinking about the number of women that receive permanent injury, particularly brain injury, as a result of domestic violence and the effects that that has on children. Now, from an Aboriginal worldview, the reasons for this level of violence in our communities has a historical factor and also has a factor in the way in which Aboriginal women have been treated and represented throughout the various parts of history. And, you know, you think about the Stolen Generations, for example. So many of the women that were removed were sexually assaulted and ended up in dreadful situations. Now, they became mothers, and those mothers became mothers. And that trauma is handed down. The other two points that I'd make, although there are many, but the two really significant points is that the Aboriginal women that I speak to don't necessarily want this to end up with the men with a criminal conviction and the possibility of going to jail. What they want to see is for the violence to stop and for men to get help. And where I've seen domestic violence programs in the Aboriginal community that are really successful is at our local community level, because the community has to own the problem before it's dealt with. And in small Aboriginal communities, you're pretty much related to everyone. So it's very difficult when it's your father or your brother or now your husband or your cousin that is the perpetrator of violence for you to be able to stand up against them. That's just some of the issues. There are others, but I think you get the drift with what I'm saying. There are different drivers.
Do you think, though, we need to find ways of empowering Aboriginal women to a much, much greater extent? And if so, how can that be done?
The answer to that question is yes. And I think the way in which it can be done is the point that I made earlier, to have local initiatives. Now, that may sound like a difficult thing, but it actually isn't. On Radio National this morning, you had the Tungundjeru Women's Council, who are this group of extraordinary women operating on the smell of an oily rag, dealing with many of the issues I've articulated to you in this podcast, but making sure that the town camps around Alice Springs are made safe. That's effective because it's local women who are taking on the issue and working collaboratively with men to address the issue. Hard to do, incredibly brave, but they do not have any permanent funding. And you can't do that job without that. So there are ways that the government can assist by providing resources for local initiatives to do what they need to do to make their community safe.
Do you think that Aboriginal men are resistant to change, and is this a problem in getting a better outcome for the women?
No, I don't think Aboriginal men are resistant to change. We have in the Aboriginal community a very strong movement in terms of men's groups, and those men's groups are about addressing the very issues that you and I are talking about. And I think the other thing is that men realise that there is a problem. They realise that they're part of the problem, but we have to find ways to make them part of the solution as well.
And how do you do that?
Well, through things like men's groups, through identifying men in the community, including high-profile men, to run educational campaigns that are culturally appropriate. And by that I mean the sort of language, the sort of imagery, what mediums you might use, be it the Aboriginal media, and the way in which you communicate the things like, you know, violence is not acceptable, we say no to violence. I mean, one of the things that I really loved that Aboriginal men did off their own bat was the use of social media to talk about being good fathers, being respectful fathers. And, you know, that was particularly successful. And social media is something that the Aboriginal community uses extensively.
There have been recently four deaths of Indigenous people while in custody, and you've spoken this week of the anger that the Aboriginal community feels about this. What concrete steps can be taken to deal with this situation, and who should be taking them?
There is enormous frustration, anger, and distress about this in the community. You saw the Black Lives Matter movement sweep across the world, and the focus in Australia was incarceration of First Nations people, as well as the issue of deaths in custody. You know, we've seen four deaths this month alone of First Nations people in custody. One was in terms of a police pursuit. And we aren't saying that all of the deaths are through mistreatment. Some of them are through poor health and you know, things like the pursuit. But it's 30 years since the Royal Commission, 339 recommendations, and yet we saw on the 5th of March a woman on remand in Silverwater hang herself in her cell. Now, one of the really important recommendations of the Royal Commission was the removal of hanging points in cells. Clearly, that has not happened everywhere. The other thing, and this goes directly to the question you've asked me, Michelle, is that if it had not been for budget estimates and questions in the New South Wales Parliament being asked, we would still be none the wiser about two of those four deaths. That was the man in Long Bay on the 2nd of March and the woman at Silverwater on the 5th of March. What I am arguing and what I would like to see, and it came out so clearly in estimates last Friday with questions from Patrick Dodson, is that the Commonwealth doesn't see itself as having a role, doesn't know who's responsible, and relies really on the media to find out about deaths. It is strongly my view that the Commonwealth should play a leadership role in this, and at the very minimum, have arrangements with states that states advise the Commonwealth, probably the Attorney General's Department, of when there is a death in custody, what the circumstances are, and that be made public.
In your acknowledgement of country at the Labor conference this week, you touched on the importance of truth-telling. Do you think that the government has a problem with truth-telling?
The government clearly has a problem with truth-telling. One of the fundamental tenets of the Uluru Statement was a national process of truth-telling. And I have not ever met one Australian who doesn't think that that's a good idea and an important thing for us as a nation to go through. Yet with the government's work on the voice to the parliament, another part of the Uluru Statement, they expressly told their three working groups that they were not to deal with the Uluru Statement, which meant they were not to deal with an enshrined voice in the constitution to the parliament, they were not to deal with the national process of truth-telling, and they were not to deal with agreement and treaty making. And, you know, I actually think that for us as a country to go through a process of truth-telling, it actually lays the foundation for the things, the other things, and many of the things that we've spoken about today. Just imagine if all of us in this country understood the truth of our history, the truth of our story. Not for people to feel guilty. It's not about that. It's so that we all have an understanding of why things are as they are within the Aboriginal community and why people feel the way that they do, and a greater understanding of Australia. I just can't see any downside to that. And yet Scott Morrison not only will not countenance an enshrined voice in the constitution that has no veto power, is simply advisory, instructed that the process of truth-telling not be part of the co-design process that's going on at the moment about a voice.
Now, your Shadow Minister for Social Services, Labor has been critical of the scaling back of the money that unemployed people receive, but Labor is always unwilling to say what the level should actually be. Isn't this a bit of a cop-out?
Well, the government has now announced a permanent change to the job seeker rate, and Labor supported that.
But the coronavirus supplement's now cut out.
That's correct. And the permanent increase, which we don't think is adequate, which is not going to address the fundamental issues of poverty, is $50, with a reintroduction of something that I have been very critical of and attempted to move amendments which weren't successful in relation to the mutual obligation requirements of the job seeker, of people who are receiving job seeker. You were right. We have not named an amount, but what I can say, Michelle, with absolute certainty, is that the broader issue of addressing poverty and hardship will be front and centre of what Labor does in government. That means that there needs to be not just work in the social security space, but work in all of the portfolios to address the issue of poverty.
The cashless card is a continuing controversial issue in the welfare debate. What's your view on how this has been working and what should be its future?
I and Labor do not support the card. Now, when you think about it, you've got four trial sites which have been going now for some time. Labor has consistently said for at least the last two, perhaps 3 years, is that we will not support a national rollout of the card. The government tried to make the four of the sites, permanent. We were able to move amendments in the Senate to stop the government from protect the government from the worst of their ideas. There are some people in the government that would like to see this card in place for all people who are in receipt of social services. I don't know if they mean people on the age pension, but I don't think they've thought it through. The other thing that's really important, Michelle, is that there is no evidence that says this card is successful. In fact, there's some research that says that it has not made any difference to things like violence, for example, or hospitalizations. So our position is that the card is an infringement on the rights of people, that it does nothing to find jobs for people, and it is also discriminatory.
The ALP conference this week supported a much more generous scheme for paid parental leave, including 26 weeks leave. Now, this isn't binding on a Labor government, but do you think that in government, Labor would try to have a more generous scheme?
I think Anthony Albanese has been quite outspoken on this. And as you've indicated, the platform has reflected, or now reflects, the aspiration, and I use that term, of having a paid parental leave scheme that is more generous than the current scheme, which I think is about 16 weeks on minimum pay. We're arguing it should be 26 weeks on full pay with entitlements, for example, superannuation and long service leave. We see this as a really important part of the gender equality debate. And I hold the view, and I think Jim Chalmers expressed it yesterday as well, that this is something that we would work towards in government. There aren't any sums to it as yet, but the platform provides a very strong direction for Labor going forward.
Now, just finally, Linda Burney, if you are Minister for Social Services after the next election, what's the one big reform you would like to make?
Gosh, that's a huge question, because it's such a huge portfolio. But the broad issue, Michelle, is to address poverty. I mean, I have the portfolio that deals with some of the most vulnerable and poor people in the community. There are some people that, and I know you well understand this, that will never be able to compete in the labour market because of mental illness or disability and a whole range of things. But the important thing is to protect the social safety net in Australia and also make it accessible for everyone that needs it. So it's really, it's not one reform. It's leading a reform process that will address poverty in the community and protecting the social safety net and making sure people have access to it.
Linda Burney, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from this Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon. But for now, goodbye.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.